I hope you enjoy this talk. These talks are always offered freely so that no one is ever denied access to them. And your support, or dana, also makes a big difference. Dana is the ancient Pali word for spontaneous generosity of heart. If you feel inspired to support these talks by offering dana, you can do so by visiting my website at www.mindfulvalley.com. Thank you so much. So who is here for the last talk, last week's talk? Okay, a lot of people. If you've missed it, as always, just a reminder that I do record these, and the summary and the first talk are both up on the podcast if you want to listen or review ever. And tonight's talk, as promised, is going to be the second of the Eightfold Path, and this will go through October, these talks. And I know that all of you won't be able to attend all of these, and why I would love that, it's really okay. All eight are really intimately connected, and so if you hear one, you're likely going to hear all the other eight within that same talk. If you'll start to notice, they're all really tied together. So as a review, the eight spokes on our wheel of Dharma, the Dhamma Chakra, are right or skillful understanding or view, and right intention. And those two, right intention and view, are both part of the wisdom part of the wheel, okay, the section. There's three sections. That's the wisdom aspect. There's speech, action, and livelihood, which are part of the ethics or sila part of the wheel. And then there's right effort, mindfulness, and concentration, which are part of the mental discipline part of our path. Those three, ethics, mental discipline, and wisdom. We need all three. So I'm going to be talking about the second spoke on our wheel tonight, and this is right or skillful intention, which in Pali is sama sankappa. Okay. And before I go on, I just really want to each time review the word right when I say right intention or right view. It does not in any way mean the only way or a kind of you must. This is you must, it's right. It's not dictatorial. It's more of this is considered the wisest, most beneficial, most wholesome way. Okay, and you get to decide that. It's not any way dictatorial. Really, it means this is what I have discovered will lead to the most beneficial outcome for all. That's what the Buddha is kind of telling us. And as I mentioned earlier, the path is considered a kind of a wheel that we continue to turn or continue to walk on to deepen our understanding. I like to think of it as a labyrinth, but you go in and then you go out and then you go back in again. It's really a circle. It's also really important, even though it's a circle and we continue to walk this, that we need to start with the two wisdom spokes, okay? Right view and right intention, since these two are going to help point us in the right direction. These two are our compass for the whole path. So if you're going to go out on a journey, you're going to need a compass to help you, and these are our compass. And ultimately, according to the teachings, our intention is really everything. Our intention, everything rests on the pin of intention in practice. So if we don't have a compass as we head out on our path and we don't know what direction that we're headed in, we're very likely to get totally lost, if you look at it that way. And maybe more importantly, we might start walking down a path that will not lead us to happiness at all, but might even lead us to more suffering, really, if we don't have that compass. I always find it helpful to remember that right intention is also sometimes called right thought. So you'll see it listed sometimes as right thought or right thinking. The two are not separate, okay? And there's a reason for this. It's because our thoughts not only tend to become our actions, but they shape how we view things, don't they? They shape everything. And so you know, how we think about the world, situations, others, and ourselves, right? It's all based on our thinking. So, for instance, we might mistakenly believe that our private thoughts don't really count. We might think, you know, nobody can see these thoughts. Nobody's figured out a way to hack into them yet, as of yet, right? So it's our thoughts don't really matter. It's what we do, we think, you know. The only thing that matters is our outward action, you know, what we do in the world, what people see us do. This is completely inaccurate, okay, totally inaccurate. So there's an old Buddhist story about this that I love to remember. Some of you may have heard this. Many hundreds of years ago, there was a very old master, and he knew he wasn't going to live for that much longer. And he really wanted to make sure that his monastery would be well taken care of after he died. So one day he gathered all of his monks together, and he reported to them that their ancient temple was in great need of restoration. He also reported that the monastery didn't have enough money for these much-needed repairs. And he said he was really worried that if the monastery fell into ruins, the monks, after he died, would have no place to live. So he said, you know, I'm really worried about this. And of course, the monks were all dismayed to hear about their temple. They were already worried about their master, who was aging, wasn't going to live that long. And they asked him what they could do to help. What can we do? And the master said, you know what? There's only one solution. He said, not too far from here is a city which is full of wealthy people with more money in their pockets than they could ever need. I want you to go to the city and follow those rich people as they walk through the crowded streets. When no one's looking, and only when no one's looking, you must steal from them. This way we'll have enough money to keep our temple alive. And as you might imagine, the monks were all stunned by this request because they'd been taught for years by their master not to steal. You know, but the old master insisted that in this case they really had no choice. So be off, he said, be off. And remember, you must not be seen. Does everybody understand? Does everybody understand? Of course, the monks were really nervous about this, and they kind of didn't really understand it, so they were kind of shrugging. But out of a great love and respect for their master, they all agreed to honor his wishes, and they started to head out into the city. And when they'd left, the teacher noticed this one young monk still standing in the corner by himself, and he asked him why he hadn't left. Why are you still here? Why didn't you go with the others? And the young monk said, you said that we must steal without being seen. And I can do this without anyone else seeing me, but there is someone who I cannot avoid, and he will always see me steal. Who's this? Asked the old monk. And he said, myself, master. How can I avoid myself? I will see myself steal. And with tears in his eyes, the old monk walked over to the younger one and embraced him and said, you have passed my test. I have found my successor, right? I just love that. I will see myself, you know. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha tells us, all that we are is the result of what we have thought. It is founded on our thoughts. It is made up of our thoughts. If someone speaks or acts with an evil thought, pain follows them as the wheel follows the foot of the ox that draws the carriage. All that we are is the result of what we have thought. It is founded on our thoughts. It is made up of our thoughts. If someone speaks or acts with a pure thought, happiness follows them like a shadow that never leaves. So Mahatma Gandhi said it beautifully this way. Our beliefs become our thoughts. Our thoughts become our words. Our words become our actions. Our actions become our habits. Our habits become our values. And our values become our destiny. Okay? So the Buddha actually gave us a really more succinct way of remembering this, I think, which is just simply whatever one reflects upon frequently becomes the inclination of the mind. Whatever one reflects upon frequently becomes the inclination of the mind. So that's even a practice right there. What are you thinking about all day? Really ask yourself that. Is it good, wholesome thoughts, or is it thoughts of hatred? Right? So when we're thinking about hatred, or resentment, or anger, angry thoughts, guess what? That's what we're practicing, right? So our thoughts, our intentions, are really crucial in this practice. And in the teachings on right intention, the Buddha talks about three kinds of right intention, which I'm going to go over. So there's three: the intention of renunciation, the intention of goodwill or metta, and the aspiration to do no harm, those three. And all of these three are meant to counter what are considered the unwholesome or poisonous intentions of desire and aversion and an urge to harm. So you might recall that in the second noble truth, all these ones and truths, these are the four noble truths, the second noble truth, the Buddha tells us that there is a reason why we suffer. The first noble truth, of course, is that there is suffering. And the reason we suffer is because of our desire and grasping, our aversion, our ill will, and our delusion. And the delusion is not understanding that aversion and desire are what cause us to suffer. It's delusion. So the second part of the Eightfold Path, then, is having as our focus the ongoing intention to create less suffering for ourselves and others through our thinking, through our intention. Okay? And we do this actively and consciously by remembering and practicing these three things: renunciation, letting go, nekama in Pali, wishing others well, metta in Pali, and honoring our aspiration to do no harm to ourselves or others, which is ahimsa. Okay, no harm. So on the surface, this might actually feel like or seem like an easy task in a way. It's like, all right, I get it. All I have to do is become a happier person is just chill out a bit and, you know, be nicer to myself and others. Got it, check. That's easy. But in the Buddhist practice, it's often said that just following the heart isn't enough. We also need to bring our mind along with us. We need to bring our mind along with us. We need both. And, you know, before the Buddha became enlightened, when he was still Prince Siddhartha, he spent 49 very intense days in formal practice under the Bodhi tree, contemplating how his mind worked and what effect it produced. That's what he was sitting with. And what he wasn't just following his breath and getting blissed out. He was contemplating the nature of his mind. And what he discovered was that his thoughts can be divided into two types. One type of thought produced happiness, and the other produced suffering. That also sounds really simple, doesn't it? Right? Just those two things. And as the story goes, whenever Siddhartha noticed thoughts of greed, aversion, or harmfulness arise in him, he understood that those thoughts, quote, lead to harm for oneself or others, obstruct wisdom, and lead away from nirvana. And the more he noticed how thoughts of greed, aversion, and the intention to harm affected him, his intention to practice eliminating these thoughts from his mind became even stronger because he could clearly see the connection and the effect that those thoughts had on his body, right? And his heart. On the other hand, whenever thoughts of renunciation, letting go, goodwill or thoughts of no harm arose, he, quote, understood those thoughts to be beneficial, conducive to the growth of wisdom, and an aid to the attainment of nirvana. Right? So then he worked on nurturing and strengthening and cultivating, very consciously cultivating thoughts that involved letting go, goodwill, and no harm. Okay? So this is where the practice of mental discipline comes in, because it is crucial for us to practice the formal silent meditation, as we did tonight, so that we can see into and get really familiar with the nature of our minds. That's the crucial part of insight meditation practice. We want to notice that. Sometimes, you know, people in my MBSR workshops that I used to offer would confess to me that they hadn't been doing their homework, but, you know, they weren't doing their daily formal practice, but they were really working hard throughout the day to become more mindful. And this is really a great and honorable intention, but it gets back to the three aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is we need all three: wisdom, ethics, and the compassion practice, and mental discipline, which comes from the formal practice. We get the mental discipline part of it from the formal practice. So I just want to throw that out there to you as encouragement to really try to do your practice more often. It's going to be really difficult for us to discover the wisdom aspect of the path without the formal practice, without the mental discipline, because we aren't going to truly experience the truth of emptiness or no self, which we can get through the formal practice. Which means we're likely going to continue to hold on to and defend and protect and try to satisfy a sense of a separate self. We're going to protect that and defend it. And this means we aren't going to be as kind or compassionate to others, because they might in some way seem threatening when we're so clinging tightly to a sense of self. We also aren't going to be able to see how our thoughts are really truly affecting us, how they're causing us dukkha, or how ephemeral or unreal they are. We're going to believe them more. So we aren't going to see how they're causing us suffering because we're going to be believing them. And we're not going to see how ephemeral they are, how transitory they are, because we're also clinging to them. Okay? You know, without our formal practice, we're mostly going to continue to believe our thoughts, which are maybe formed many years ago, decades ago, some of these beliefs and thoughts, and then we're going to act on those thoughts, right? We act on our thoughts. So through the formal practice, we can more clearly see what we're believing and thinking and how this affects ourselves and others. And then what we can do through our practice and in our daily lives, because our practice should bleed out into our daily lives as well, is that we can learn to weed out the thoughts that are harmful to ourselves and to others, and to nurture those that are going to benefit ourselves and others, just like we might weed out our garden. Okay? We weed the mind. The Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh tells us, in each of us there are flowers and there is also garbage. The garbage is the anger, fear, discrimination, and jealousy within us. If we water the garbage, we will strengthen those negative seeds. If we water the flowers of compassion, understanding, and love, we will strengthen the positive seeds. What we grow is up to us. What we grow is up to us. So we have a choice, which is great news. And according to the traditional Buddhist teaching, actually every single moment of our lives involves an intention and a choice. I'll give you another practice maybe, which is to start noticing it. It can be a little crazy-making, actually. But start to notice, for instance, just think about this for a moment. You chose to be here tonight, didn't you? I hope so. There was a choice in there. You might not have even been conscious of it, but you might have. Or maybe it's a habit. Tuesday nights I go, right? Or, you know, you chose where you were going to sit tonight, didn't you? Right? People are in kind of similar places where they usually are, I think. This morning, you chose what to eat and what to wear, what to put on, right? Every single second of your life, every moment, you're making a choice. Check it out. So there's an intention behind there, and then there's a choice. So the Buddha is asking us to do this consciously, you know, maybe not totally obsessively, because this might, again, make us crazy. But it's actually a really interesting practice. So if you want to chew on that this week. He's simply urging us, basically, to plant these three seeds of intention and then notice how we're nurturing and watering these seeds. Because again, as Thich Nhat Hanh tells us, you know, what we nurture and water, that's what's going to grow. So if we're planting and watering seeds of greed and hate, this is what is going to blossom. That's going to blossom within us. You know, don't go to a peace rally angry. That whole thing. You know, if we're thinking that son of a every single day, which we might be, you know, that's what we're nurturing, sadly. And if we're planting and nourishing thoughts of love and generosity, gratitude, you know, this is what's going to blossom. And the Buddha is also saying that the seeds of hate are like weeds. So when we see them, when we notice them in the mind, we pluck them, we get them out of there, and we replace them with flowers, maybe healthy vegetables, if you want to go with that metaphor. So let's explore these three intentions a little bit more. So the first, if you recall, of these intentions is to let go, renunciation, nakama, which I admit just is a heavy word. Renunciation sounds big, doesn't it? So it's like sometimes we hear that word and it sounds like in some way we're supposed to punish ourselves or deprive ourselves. We're renouncing X, Y, and Z. Or people worry that if they start following the Buddhist teachings, you know, sooner or later they're going to be asked to give away all their things and shave their heads and join a monastery. And that's not it either. Renunciation simply means letting go of our attachment. So it's also not that we're being asked to let go of or reject our family, our friends, all of our things, or even ourselves. What we're being asked to do is let go of our attachment to these things, our mistaken sense that these are ours. This body, this is mine, right? Or my house, or my family. It's a mistaken belief that this is ours. And that might be a hard one, but maybe plunk that seed of thought in the mind. It's not mine. I do not own that. So we're also being asked to stop clinging so tightly to our ideas and our beliefs and our opinions, knowing that most of these are conditioned by our upbringing, our culture, all the things that we've experienced in our lives, which means they may not be accurate. Right? And this absolutely includes all our beliefs, all the beliefs we have about who we are. And this is what we're being asked actually to renounce especially, because it tends to cause us so much suffering, right? Check that out. All our beliefs about self. So easy, right? Not so much. Which is why the Buddha offers us the practice of meditation. So instead of repressing our thoughts and desires and beliefs, and treating them with aversion or shame, I shouldn't be thinking or feeling, et cetera, which only, as we all know, pushes them down under the surface. The Buddha is offering us another way, which is understanding our thoughts. I love the way The modern monk and scholar Bhikkhu Bodhi describes it. He says, when we understand the nature of desire, when we investigate it closely with keen attention, desire falls away by itself without need for struggle. I'm going to read that again. When we understand the nature of desire, when we investigate it closely and with keen attention, desire falls away by itself without need for struggle. And so this is often described as like a tree shedding its leaves. We don't need to force the tree to let go of the leaves. Eventually, this happens totally naturally once we understand, once we see how much suffering it's causing us. It naturally falls away. Makes logical sense. Which brings us back to the first and second noble truths, which is, again, there is suffering and there's a reason for suffering. And when we can see the suffering inherent in clinging so tightly, the mind almost naturally, organically, starts to incline towards renunciation, letting go. Because we can see more and more clearly exactly how we're imprisoned by our own mind, right? Many of you know the story about how they sometimes still catch monkeys in India, right? All they need to do is put a banana into a glass bottle and tie a rope around the bottle. And the monkey is able to put its little hand into the thin part of the bottle, and then it grabs the banana, and it won't let go. So it's trapped. You know, it's trapped simply because it won't let go of this banana. All it has to do is let go. And so it's the same with us. All we need to do is let go. But we want to cling so tightly. Which brings us to the second intention that the Buddha offers us, which is goodwill or metta, loving kindness. So as we become less and less attached, stopped clinging so tightly to a solid sense of self, a separate me, I, me, mine, we start to recognize more and more that just like ourselves, all beings suffer, all beings experience dukkha, suffering. And we recognize more and more clearly that our happiness really does depend on the happiness of others. We are all interdependent, really. So the truth is that when others are unhappy, when they don't understand the causes of happiness, you know, they tend to create suffering all around them, don't they? Maybe even, you know, all over the world, if they have that much power. They don't understand the causes of suffering, the causes of happiness. You know? So we really actually do want to, even though it's hard, we really want to do wish for others' happiness, for them to know for the causes of happiness, so that they will not create so much suffering in the world. I wish for that. Please know the true causes of happiness so that you can stop creating so much suffering in your life and suffering for others. And even if this won't ever come out about, by the way, the practice is to wish for this. Even if, you know, we're being asked to wish for the happiness of all beings, even if this may never come about, we're asked to have this intention in our own hearts because it helps to counter the poisons of greed and aversion and delusion within ourselves, within our own hearts. That's why we do the practice. And with everything else in practice, as always, we always start with ourselves. Right? We begin by offering metta to ourselves. So when we can practice being friendly and kind to ourselves and all of our conditioning, all of our beliefs, all of the ugly stuff that we just don't like in ourselves, if we can start practicing bringing kindness to that, right, we'll start to recognize that this wish to be happy is universal. Anybody here not want to be happy? Right? It's universal. We're all trying so hard. And the more we practice, the more we begin to really understand experientially that what we believe is our suffering is really the suffering. Not my suffering, it's the suffering. Which leads us to opening our hearts to everyone and everything, and our kindness and compassion eventually becomes unlimited, which means, you know, it's not let me be kind and compassionate to that person or this particular group of people that I like who believe the same things that I believe, but to all beings everywhere. In the Metta Sutta, the Buddha offers this prayer or aspiration, which is happy at rest, may all beings be happy at heart. Whatever beings there may be, weak or strong, without exception, long, large, middling, short, subtle, blatant, seen and unseen, near and far, born and seeking birth, may all beings be happy at heart. Let no one deceive another or despise anyone anywhere, or through anger or irritation wish for another to suffer. That's a tall order. Yeah. But the truth is, you know, despising or hating people is never ever going to achieve anything except more hate. That's the truth. And the Dhammapada, the Buddha famously tells us, hate is never conquered by hate. Hate is conquered by love. This is an eternal law. This is an eternal law. You know, and just as a confession, for as long as I can remember, I have never understood the logic of putting those who have committed crimes into cages, into concrete block cells as punishment. As I was writing this, I was thinking about, I've never understood that. You know, people who have caused harm in society may need to be kept out of society for a little while for their own good and for the common good, because it's also considered compassionate to say no. You know, what you did or are doing is not right and it needs to stop. That's a compassionate thing to do for the common good and for the person's good. But in my eyes, and you may disagree with me, they need our help in some way, not our punishment. Not our punishment. And by the way, I don't think those who are asking for our help should be put into cages. Getting a little teary-eyed. Nor should babies or little children, you know? But that's another talk. So, I don't know where I first saw this, but it was a photo of a sign on the door of a factory that said, "The beatings will continue until morale improves. Right? It just doesn't make any sense. You know? And yet I think, as most of us can attest, when it comes to ourselves in particular, don't we often so often start with judgment and criticism and sometimes even punishment when we've done something? Isn't that true? Isn't that often how we relate to ourselves? Just check it out in yourself maybe this week. How do you relate? You know, is it with kindness, oh honey, it's okay? Or is it with judgment, oh you idiot, or whatever it is? And then punishment, I gotta do something. This totally goes against the teachings the Buddha was trying to offer us, judgment, criticism. No. And so the Buddha's teachings of hatred is never conquered by hatred absolutely needs to include ourselves. Has to include ourselves, you know. And if we really think about it, another thing we tend to do is think that if we're just harder on ourselves, if we just punish ourselves a little bit more, then we'll change, right? Then we'll change. It's like we tend to put ourselves inside our own cages and our own jails, and we become our own harsh jailers. And what those prisoners, and actually we ourselves need instead of punishment, is our compassion. our compassion, which is the key element in the third of the intentions the Buddha offers us, which is to not wish harm on any being, ahimsa, you know, not wish harm. So putting someone in a cage is harmful, isn't it? It just is. So this third intention is actually led, it's led by the practice of compassion, karuna, which is a verb, it's an action. In the Buddhist teachings, it's called a quivering of the heart, and in response to pain. And, you know, it's also an intention. So it's an action and it's an intention. Maybe the intention comes first, and then there's an action with compassion. So the more we see the truth of the first noble truth, there is suffering, and really see the depth of it, the more and more we're going to wish to not only not bring any more harm into the world, but to ask ourselves, how can we eliminate that suffering? It turns to that, you know? So can just, I don't want to bring any more harm in, and then it's like, how can I help? How can I stop the suffering? And according to the Metta Sutta, we should cultivate for all beings the same love that a mother would feel for her child. And this includes our love for ourselves, to treat ourselves in that way. And of course, you know, this is our practice. This is our edge, because it's so difficult, especially when we try to offer kindness and compassion to those who are really causing great harm. That's so hard. So I think it's hard, first of all, for ourselves, offer ourselves kindness. That's the hard one. But then if someone's really causing harm, man, that's hard. What helps me sometimes is to remember the quote by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, who I believe was channeling the Buddha a bit, when he wrote, "If we could read the secret history of our enemies, we should find in each man's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility." So whenever we're being harsh towards anyone in our thinking, you know, we might remember that. Remember that. That we all have that. And I would suggest that whenever we're being harsh towards ourselves, we might remember that too. Really, try to pause and take some time to remember all the things that you've been through. You ever do that for yourself? Everything you've been through? You know? And remember that you too deserve your own kindness and compassion and forgiveness. Really important. So with this third intention, do no harm, we might practice constantly, consciously asking ourselves, is what I'm thinking or saying or doing in some way adding more harm or suffering? Or is it helping others to be happier, adding more good in the world? And you could change that around for yourself as well, right? Is what I'm thinking or saying or doing in some way adding more harm or suffering to myself? Or is it helping me to be happier and to be it more of a force of good in the world? And check it out. Sometimes I just use another one of those sticky note phrases that I like, which is, what would Buddha do? What would Buddha do? What would he do, really? What would Buddha do? How would Buddha be in this situation? What would his thoughts be, even, in this situation? What would his words be? What would his actions be in this situation? And finally, as a kind of caution, I want to mention that when we don't consciously work to cultivate right understanding and right intention, what happens is that we can very often unconsciously cause great suffering for ourselves and others. Bhikkhu Bodhi describes it this way, and I'll end with this. When wrong views prevail, the outcome is wrong intention giving rise to unwholesome actions. Thus, one who measures achievement in terms of gain and status will aspire to nothing but gain and status, using whatever means he can to acquire them. When such pursuits become widespread, The result is suffering, the tremendous suffering of individuals, social groups, and nations out to gain wealth, position, and power without regard to consequences. The cause for the endless competition, conflict, injustice, and oppression does not lie outside the mind. These are all just manifestations of intentions, outcroppings of thoughts driven by greed, by hatred, by delusion. But when the intentions are right, the actions will be right. And for the intentions to be right, the surest guarantee is right views. So I'm going to end with that and just invite everybody just for a moment into meditation, contemplation to end. I'm just taking a nice deep breath in, deep breath out, letting everything go and dropping in. I'm going to invite those of you who'd like to place a hand on the heart or both hands, maybe one on the heart, one on the belly, breathing into the fingers. I'm going to ask you to investigate, what is your heart's deepest wish or intention? Not the surface wish. What's your heart's deepest aspiration or intention? Remembering that everything rests on intention. So once you've tapped into that intention, see if you can invite a kind of nurturing of that intention, watering that seed of intention. Maybe having the intention to water that intention. To continue to water that intention. And let it lead you. Let that lead you. In each one of us, there are flowers, and there's also garbage. And the garbage is the anger, fear, discrimination, and jealousy within us. And if we water the garbage, we will strengthen the negative seeds. If we water the flowers of compassion, understanding, and love, we will strengthen the positive seeds. What we grow is up to us. What we grow is up to us.